Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by my bookshop, Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Emmeron Meyer, whose books are sitting on our front table right now and in the window. So today's book is The Gut-Immune Connection. So Emmeron also wrote The Mind-Gut Connection. These are both standalone books published by Harper. But after you read this one, I would strongly suggest that you read the first, because that gives you a full understanding of the connection we mostly ignore in our lives. His research has been supported for the last 25 years by the National Institute of Health. So the gut, in addition to it being our second brain, which you'll find out a little bit more from the first book, what exactly is the gut? I mean, it's the gastrointestinal system. I mean, it's our digestive tract. It's a bunch of organs, the mouth, the esophagus, he can correct me, the stomach, the pancreas, all ending up with the rectum. It was funny, getting ready for this, I was realizing, you know, I was thinking this is not something we think about. But then I realized in the English idiom and colloquially, we'll say things like somebody spills one's guts, or it's a gut issue, or you have a gut response, or you hate somebody's guts, or he's gutless, or I have a gut-wrenching feeling. And I thought about that, you know, why am I always saying gut? I mean, I don't even understand why I'm using that word until I read this book. I didn't really understand the significance of it. So why don't you start us off there? Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me to be on your show. It's always a pleasure to explain things that, you know, I've spent a better part of my career on studying. And I'm extremely pleased the recent interest in this topic that has arisen, because for most of my career, for decades, this has really been a fringe area in gastroenterology. So I mean, starting with what you said in the beginning, the gastrointestinal tract, or the GI tract, as we call it in gastroenterology, clearly goes from, you know, from the esophagus all the way to the end of the colon and the rectum. And for a long time, and I gave lectures on this topic, we talked about it as primarily an organ or a series of components of organs that is concerned with the digestion of different aspects of food processing and absorption. So, you know, the grinding into and dispersion in the stomach, the transport by the esophagus from the mouth into the stomach, then the assimilation and digestion in the small intestine, and then you know, the waste goes into the large intestine, is stored there, water extracted and excreted. So that for a long time was the main concept of the GI tract. I would say for most of my clinical colleagues, so gastroenterology has sort of become a specialty, almost like a procedural or semi-surgical specialty of doing endoscopies, looking at the GI tract and seeing if there's anything wrong in this sequence of sub-organs that are related to digestion. But research has sort of probed much deeper into the wall of this GI tract and found, to make a long story short, that we know today it's multiple systems that are packed in a very intriguing architecture. You know, it's a very thin layer that surrounds the gut and makes up the gut. And in this thin layer that goes for quite a length, in this thin layer is sandwiched different specialized cell types. So 70% of our immune system is based in the gut, in between these layers. We have a whole, separate part of the nervous system, the enteric nervous system, or the little brain of the gut, that's also sandwiched in between. We have, you know, a big part of our hormonal system, the endocrine system, with specialized cells that have hormones. We have most of the body's serotonin stored in specialized cells. So we go from this simple mechanical device of obviously essential for life, that we can ingest food and absorb food, to something much more complex, a regulatory organ, or could call it a supercomputer that is much more important than just the digestion, that influences most organ functions. And out of those, the immune system is something that has received a lot of attention, and we can probably come to that topic, why that is so important, because it is responsible for our current chronic disease epidemic that we, most people don't really call it this or don't see it this way, but hopefully I can get this across in my book and in our conversation, why this alteration of the immune system in the gut has become such an important aspect of our health.
Before we get into, well, first of all, I should say there's some excellent recipes at the end that we can talk about, which this book is about how your diet affects your health immensely. But just for my understanding, and I'm in the middle of reading your first book now, and you talked about the little brain. And I was thinking, when I'm under situations of stress, I used to be a trial lawyer, and before I would get up and make my opening statement, I could feel this happening. I could feel this feeling in my stomach. And when I read about the second brain, I know you say it's not a conscious brain, but just for a moment, before we get back to the main topic, I think our listeners would be interested in that.
Yeah, so this example that you mentioned is something that, can occur in both positive and negative experiences. Yeah. So being a trial lawyer, being a teacher or an actor, you will get these butterflies many people get these butterflies in their stomach, which is essentially the consequence of the activation of your arousal system in the brainstem that sends signals both to the brain to make you more focused. It's actually a good thing to have that arousal because it increases your performance. But at the same time, it sends signals down to the gut and changes a lot of things. It makes it more sensitive. It changes contractions. It changes the blood flow. So essentially, it changes the way the gut functions during that arousal. Typically, so this would happen during any event or situation that you want this arousal. So it could be when you fall in love, when you see your friends again or family again after a long separation, or it can be if it's something threatening, if it's something that you're a little bit nervous about, but it usually fades down within a few minutes of actually getting involved in this activity. So that's a good thing, and it's value neutral, can happen both with good and with bad things. Just these other sensations or gut sensations, and you mentioned it earlier, it's kind of amazing in the lay public, these expressions that we have in our language that always ties the gut to emotional experiences, often more often negative than positive. So with anger, with fear, and that's not a coincidence because I mean, the way that I explain this in my book, all these emotions have a mirror image of the emotion on the face of people. So if you're well-trained, you can see that. You can see if somebody feels angry and it's a good thing, so the other person knows whom they're dealing with and how they should react. But the same thing happens in our gut. So the same signals that go from the brain to our facial muscles go to the gut and change virtually all gut functions, an important one is contractions. So to have a gut wrenching sensation, that's something when your stomach or your intestine really goes into a spasm or your sigmoid colon, it can be something that's sort of harder to describe, having a gut feeling. So non-specific feeling that something is right or something is wrong, or a decision that you make is the right decision. So that's a little bit harder to understand what physiological gut state this relates to. but it's something that if you pay attention, when I wrote the book and paid attention to that term, that somebody made a decision based on their gut feelings, you get at least 2 to 5 examples each day in the media that somebody said that.
I know. And I didn't even think about it before. But the other thing is, let's go back to try to sell this book, because I'm taking you back to the first book. One of the things, and we don't have the benefit of your charts, which I would encourage everyone to go back to YouTube after this one and look at some of the ones where Dr. Meyer has charts available, because they're excellent. But the one that's amazing is the one where you show the number of microbes versus other organs in our body. And we're talking about, I think you've mentioned 100 trillion microbes in the gut, which would make that organ, if it was an organ, bigger than our liver or bigger than our perhaps our brain, mm-hmm. in terms of microbes.
Yeah, the only reason this, the only way this is possible, because the microbes are invisible, so they're so tiny that you know, even if you compress them, you would need several million microbes before you could actually see something like a physical structure. So the tiny size of these microbes, you know, together with their phenomenal numbers, that sort of makes up what we say, like it could be another organ. And what's even more impressive than that is the number of genes that they have. So, you know, humans have 20,000 genes, which is amazingly few considering all the things that we can do and that our cells do and that our brain alone does. So we have millions of genes of microbial genes. So the majority of the genes, if you put this together, and you know, people have called this a holobiont. So you put the microbes, microbial life and human life together, it's this holobiont. The majority of the genes come from the microbes. And what's equally interesting is that we only know a very small fraction of these genes, what they do and what they can do. The only thing we know is these microbes lived in were the dominant life form in the oceans for billions of years. And so they had a lot of time to experience and experiment and encode experiences in genes. So all this experience and intelligence, I would say it is a form of intelligence, information that they developed is stored in these genes, and we're just starting to scratch on the surface of that, you know, seemingly endless repertoire of possibilities.
You know, when I first started reading this book, or when I first saw it in my bookstore, I thought, oh, maybe this is just another holistic book that gives you an idea of how to feel better. Here's some recipes. And then I realized that there is an enormous amount of empirical evidence that over your past 25 years, your career in gastroenterology, and it began to become clear as you began further into the book that we're not talking about, hey, I'm okay, you're okay. This is something very scientific, which leads me to the question of, are you optimistic that your conclusions in this book and the idea of American crisis in health, are you optimistic? I know I'm going a little far afield here, but are you optimistic that your book or anything will help Americans to ameliorate the situation that we find ourselves in now?
Yeah, so I would say I'm actually, you know, grateful that when 5 years ago, we published an interesting paper about how microbes can affect the brain, first one in humans at the time, that I was contacted by publishers and a couple of agents, and they convinced me that I should write a book for the lay public, because that has sort of really fundamentally changed my main mission in life, in my professional life, that I still love and find it very important to teach students on this path in a holistic way, or looking at the body in a holistic way and in a systems biological way. But I don't really need to sort of spread that knowledge amongst my colleagues and get credit for it and be, you know, getting awards for it. I think it's much more important for me to help educate the public and contribute something to the public, to the public good, really, in changing this direction that, you know, that we find ourselves on in the U.S. and also in some other Western countries. But it's probably one of the worst scenarios that we're on is really in the U.S., the biggest crisis. So I have to be optimistic. Otherwise, I would be wasting my time if I thought this is hopeless. You know, I would not do that. And I do see progress. And I often wonder, you know, I don't live in the most typical part of the U.S. So the west side of Los Angeles is full of, and you know, the same thing in San Francisco, is full of people that want to live healthier. And you know, there's all the markets that you have that offer all kinds of healthy food and got healthy food. So it's not that hard to convince people locally here, you know, that, but then there's vast parts of the country that have no clue about this. You know, and it's unfortunately breaks also down in socioeconomic terms, that the education to reach people at a lower socioeconomic level it's pretty non-existent in terms of the healthy diet.
Yeah, I know. I mean, if you go to the supermarket and you see that 70 or 80% of the things you're buying have high fructose corn syrup, or if you're living in an impoverished area and you don't even have a supermarket and you're going to McDonald's or Wendy's, and the recipes are excellent, but some of the ingredients are esoteric enough that, as you're saying, if you're in that demographic, you might not be able to find them. So there may be some kind of alternative, plant-based alternative that would be simpler, I guess. And you discussed that to a certain extent.
Yeah, there is. And, you know, I think what it would take, in some ways, I regret a little bit that I didn't address this more. You know, I mean, the book is obviously targeted at the most likely buyers of this book. And, you know, that it's more likely in affluent portions of the country. But I have been thinking about, you know, and other people have done this as well, there's been political barriers to that, to really go where it would be most needed. So these children, you know, in preschool or in kindergarten, or their parents or mothers, you know, that struggle, you know, to make it, to really go to these areas of society and teach them simple things. You know, they don't have to buy, you know, all the fancy things we put into some of these recipes, but simply being on a largely plant-based diet, in some ways it should be a lot cheaper. So if you weren't so, if the food market wouldn't be so distorted by subsidies, then a plant-based diet should be a lot cheaper than the meat-based diet with hamburgers and sausages. But that unhealthy diet is subsidized, so that you can, you know, buy a hamburger meal for a family of five, that would be cheaper than, you know, getting something healthy, plant-based, is ridiculous, you know, or that a sugary soda would be equally expensive or more expensive or less expensive than water, in a bottle of water. Yeah. You know? So this is a real problem that, you know, and once it gets to that, I'm a little bit less optimistic. You know, how is this going to be changed?
I mean, again, I talked about the charts, but you have one that's kind of a Venn diagram where, more esoterically, you talk, one of your chapters is called One Health. And you have this kind of Venn diagram which connects environmental human health and plant and soil health intersecting with this concept of One Health. And yes, it's somewhat esoteric, but explain that, because that goes back to the simpler thing we were talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the One Health concept, I mean, this term has been used before, you know, it's not been coined by me, but I've kind of adapted it to the way I look about it. It starts with gut health, microbial health, brain health, human health. But then when you talk about a healthy diet, this has to be grown in a healthy soil, which means the soil has a microbiome. The interactions of the microbes in the soil with the plants are very similar to the interactions of the microbes in our gut with our gut and with the rest of the body. So if you want to have the maximum benefit from eating plants. They should be rich in these phytonutrients and phytochemicals that have these health promoting effects, like the polyphenols or antioxidants. And in order to accomplish that, you get into a whole other area, how we have been treating, how industrial agriculture has been treating the soil. There's a great film, Kiss the Ground, an organization that sort of promotes this. We're basically destroying, similar to what we've done with antibiotics to our microbes and with chemicals, farming has been doing to the microbes in the soil and on plants. And then we also realize that our over-reliance on animal food sources, you know, red meat and dairy products, it's subsidized, but it has a high hidden cost. And that cost is to feed all these animals. They have to be fed, they're being fed with soybeans. In order to grow cheap soybeans, this has to be done with genetically engineered crop and using pesticides and herbicides. So this has a huge effect on the health of the environment, but also on the climate. I mean, cutting down the rainforest to plant soybeans is something that, so most people don't think about this connection. Like, you know, everybody feels sad when you see pictures of burning forests in Brazil. Well, the reason it's happening is so in order that we can have cheap hamburgers in the US. A lot of this soybean actually goes to Asia in the meantime, 40%. And so they can have the same unhealthy dietary habits that you know that we have introduced. Just to wrap this up, so you realize it goes from the health of our gut and our personal health to the plant health, the soil health, and ultimately to planetary health. And I've become really passionate about this concept and trying to remind audiences what you do individually has a ripple effect through all these health systems, you know, around the world.
Well, you know, you were writing the book before COVID, and you do mention COVID parenthetically. And I started thinking about, you know, I just turned 69 and I was socially distancing and I felt fairly comfortable because I try to eat right, I exercise. But then I thought, okay, the things that what you're saying lead to are diabetes, high blood pressure, obesity. And if I were those things, then COVID would have treated me a lot differently. And so I thought, really, again, looking back at your recipes, like I'm looking right now at the avocado hummus dip, which sounds delicious. Yeah, looking back at your recipes and what you've just been talking about, it's this century. I mean, there's a prediction that in 30 years, half of Americans will have diabetes. Mm-hmm. It's absurd.
It is absurd. And, you know, I always say, I mean, obviously the most urgent health problem, health crisis was the pandemic. And it's a good example of how phenomenally competent our science, you know, can be, and the medical system and the pharmaceutical industry. This has been a really high point of that. But we've almost forgotten of this ongoing, you know, chronic disease epidemic, non-infectious disease epidemic that has started after World War II with, you know, the accelerated industrial agriculture and the food production and processing. So people always forget this, and this doesn't seem to be that urgent. The reason is because the mortality, I mentioned this in my book also, the mortality from these diseases, for example, heart attacks and strokes, has been stable or has been decreasing because we're throwing billions of medications at it to counteract it. We have not changed the prevalence of these diseases. So we let this epidemic go on. In some ways, you could almost say it's a boon for the pharmaceutical industry because they'll be busy selling their medications. And you see it on TV commercials every night. You know, it's amazing that every 2 minutes there's a commercial about some.
I don't understand. You know, every night I watch Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune, and the number, other than insurance commercials, the number of commercials, and then you look at the small print, And the difference for someone with a small cell metastatic breast cancer, the difference if you take the drug for a fortune or not is 3 months of life, which would be more miserable because of the side effects. And in addition, it's just amazing that when you look at the clinical information that's inside your prescription, you can see that the placebo effect is sometimes just several percentage points different.
It's that, and you know, many of the commercials, when it brings it back to this immune theme, many of the advertisements are for these medications that we call biologics, you know, that are being developed to suppress or antagonize this inappropriate immune system activation that leads to diseases like inflammatory bowel disease or, you know, like many autoimmune diseases. Many of these diseases have an abnormal activation of the immune system as a core. And so patients don't ask why are these immune problems that we need all these medications with horrible side effects. So nobody asks that question. And one important one is clearly this link between our diet, and it's, you know, it's called the Standard American Diet, the acronym SAD, S-A-D, which is kind of an appropriate name for it, the state of this diet. It's the interaction of that kind of diet with the microbes and the immune system that is involved in many of these diseases, including, as you said, the vulnerability to develop COVID-19 or develop a more severe form or develop this long COVID complication that symptoms don't go away. So
I guess one of the things in your book is for the layperson who learns a great deal that he or she didn't know before, one of the questions I had, and it's a question you've been asked before, is, okay, what exactly is the microbiome and how do we know if ours is healthy? We take some of the ameliorating tasks that you've assigned to us, plant-based, drink more water. How would we know empirically in our own minds, other than feeling better, how do you know that your microbiome is a healthy one or that you're getting better, so to speak?
Yeah, so there's an empiric way. So you could just follow these recommendations, particularly dietary-wise. You can follow your BMI, your body weight, your, you know, hip to waist ratio, and just say if all these parameters and your blood pressure, you know, you go to the doctor and you don't have high fat values, abnormal cholesterol, you could say that if all of these are in the right direction, and if you were obese and then they normalized, you're doing something right. You know, you can, and you know that the microbiome plays some role in this. So this would be a purely empiric way of doing it. The more modern way is obviously to try to look at the microbes themselves or look at measures of this immune system activation in the blood, which are not part of your routine blood tests that you get,
right.
but this could be done. Now the microbiome tests, that's a whole other story. There's several commercial tests available today. Some, I would say, are pretty useless because the earlier ones, they just tell you what's the relative abundance of different types of microbes, and they make all these elaborate charts. And patients come to me with these charts because they're so complicated that they don't really understand them. And at the same time, the field has moved on that we're now realizing what's most important is actually what these microbes produce, what signaling molecules, what chemicals they produce. That's a different way of analyzing it. It's called metatranscriptomics or metagenomics or metabolomics. And there's very few, there's probably, to my knowledge, only one test right now that does that. The problem is you would need, or you do need artificial intelligence to extract that information that you get from these, you know, hundreds of thousands of metabolites in your system, in your gut, and in your blood, to extract patterns that are either indicative that you are in a bad metabolic state or that you have an increased risk for developing Alzheimer's disease or diabetes. That last point, it will happen, but we're not there yet. Even though some of the commercial, the companies that offer these tests, say that their conclusions and recommendations are based on artificial intelligence. We're not at this point yet. You know, it's premature to say. In 5 years from now, definitely in 10 years, but I don't think it will take that long, this will be a standard test that people undergo when they go to their physician or do at home. They don't even have to go to their physician, and they will get something that we have right now, you know, with companies like 23andMe, they will tell you you have a genetic risk for Alzheimer's disease and increase. I think that will happen fairly soon. So the microbial health assessment definitely, you know, coming to us in the near future.
The interesting thing is, you know, when I use the word holistic, people have different feelings about it. But both of your books deal with interconnectivity. They actually say it in the title. So I think, I don't know whether my physician, when he gives me my physical, maybe in a doctor of osteopathy, but I don't know whether physicians actually are trained enough or have that mindset where they realize that there is this connection and this wetware and our gut are really one thing connected closely together. And yes, I'm playing devil's advocate, of course, and that's why we're having this conversation. But I don't honestly think that many doctors look at things the way you're portraying them.
No, that is true. And, you know, I think I've always had this kind of, I don't know where this comes from. You know, I've always been interested in connections between different parts of information or reality or throughout my career from the early on. But I think it's also been accelerated by, you know, being a scientist and looking what's happened in science. So everything now is, you know, has at the end this syllable omics. So it's genomics, it's microbiome, which means we're no longer looking at individual cells. We're looking at connected systems. And we're now beginning to connect something that's called multi-omics integration. We're now looking mathematically how we can integrate information from the immune system and the genetic system and, you know, the gut system and the brain. So it's becoming the new scientific reality. This has not made it through into medical school curricula. The medical school curricula is still based on linear, mechanistic, one-way communication. Something goes wrong, you take out that part or replace it. And so this will take, I mean, you know, before things like this get into textbooks, it usually takes 10 years. And we have students, so, you know, one thing I'm particularly proud of, that students that rotate through our center with research projects, they get that message, you know, and they really enjoy it. I should also say they're almost exclusively female students. I think the female brain is more adapted to see these interconnections. And I could give you a whole talk on why I think that is, but so one of our research grants is on sex differences in the brain-gut microbiome axis. So we've spent a lot of time thinking about what's different about the female brain that, you know, makes women researchers, women physicians more likely to adapt these kind of holistic concepts.
Yeah, it's funny because I can almost intuit that myself. You know, maybe it's something to have to do with the maternal instinct or that they're what allow us to continue as a race. But yeah, I never probably would have thought of. But so your students, who are you teaching? What are they majoring in? And what are generally their goal? I know I'm asking questions you don't usually get, but I'm curious as to who you're teaching, what their goals are, what they plan to do with their careers.
Yeah, so, you know, it's gone through different stages. So, I mean, I have this dual appointment in physiology. So this was really teaching, undergrads in basic physiology. I've not been doing this for a few years, but have really focused my energy on students that come to us that, you know, and I get requests like on a constant basis that want to work in our center. They're typically undergrads, with neuroscience majors. Most of them do this because they want to get into medical school. So these are really pre-med students to a large degree, with some exceptions. And yeah, I would say, you know, 90% of the students have that goal. Not all of them make it. It's fiercely competitive. But yeah, that, and so they get sometimes, you know, it's fairly common now to take a gap year. So that would spend at least a year with us just doing research on any of these questions of the brain gut microbiome axis. And we get a few scientists who want to have a scientific career, but it's a minority. Mainly it's many pre-med students.
It's funny because, you know, before you did this work, people won't know unless they look up your CV or your Wikipedia entry, but a lot of your work is scientific papers, abstracts. Yeah. And now that you've entered into this, for want of a better term, popular science, popular medicine, do you have, okay, so we've discussed these two connections. One, between the mind, whether we're talking about the brain or the mind, that's for another day, the mind and the gut. And now we're talking about basically dietary and immunity. What would be, if there is one, a third connection between the gut and us? Is there? I don't know if that's a bad question.
Say that again. So
well, because you've dealt with this and how it's connected to this and how they're really connected, because there's this little brain here, even though it's not conscious. And now you've spoken about, okay, here we are here. We need to keep this in really good shape in order to have long and healthy lives. And like I said, it's off the wall question, but is there something else? I mean, like where the soul resides, or whether there's some other secret that the gut provides for us. Because when I went through those expressions that you and I discussed, why is it that we decided over the last 1,000 years that that's what we're going to use? That I hate his guts, for example. Where would that come from? I hate his guts.
Very, very good point. You know, and I mean, obviously, you know, Freud has sort of played with these phases relating, you know, different psychological developmental stages with, you know, with the gut, the, you know, the anal phase and the oral phase. He didn't really mention the gut itself, but it's with the two entry and exit points. Yeah, I mean, as a scientist, I'm always open to this possibility that there will be new things that will either change our current concepts or that will add to it. So the microbiome itself is a good example. I thought, you know, 10 years ago that just understanding how the brain and the gut interact is sufficient to explain most things that I was interested in with my patients. I could give patients a pretty good story, what's underlying their, you know, symptoms of IBS, or, you know, what happens in inflammatory bowel diseases. And then the microbiome came and we had to expand that concept.
Exactly. That's what I was asking.
With the new science and the way science moves forward, and particularly the way we understand, you know, new aspects of the mind that would have been fringe even, you know, even a few years ago, I think we're then also with this whole thing with artificial intelligence, how we sort of compare, you know, where does artificial intelligence take us?
Exactly.
That surpass the brain's capacity, and are in the future, you know, if you have machines that work on artificial intelligence but don't have a gut, do they miss a big part of their abilities making gut-based decisions, for example? Yeah, I'm totally open to this possibility, and I do like to speculate about these kind of things. I would not be surprised. I mean, I told you earlier, you know, there's billions of years of evolution that these microbes have learned to communicate and interact with each other. There's millions of genes that they have stored that intelligence in. Could there be, for example, you know, the microbiome, not just in our gut, but their connections to the soil and to the water? Could this be some form of proto-intelligence, you know, that is actually wiser than anything else?
You just called it intelligence. And that's exactly what I was getting at, whether there's a whether there's a kind of consciousness, and maybe that's an additional connection. But
and it's something that, you know, we obviously right now on a collision course with disaster, with climate change and all this, and unfortunately a lot of people will die because of that. You know, we've always been on the verge of a nuclear war, and the microbes will never disappear. This is the interesting thing. You know, they have the best survival skills of all life forms. They have not disappeared with the mass extinctions. And part of it is probably this intelligence, you know, that they use in a way widely distributed around the world, invisible. You know, you could almost say, yeah, so some of these, I don't want to go that far, but, you know, some of these cosmic intelligence concepts that people, you know, some religions have, could they be part of that? You know,
I'm glad I pulled that out of you. That was, I consider that successful. Well, as we conclude, I thought when I was done the book, I was done the book. But as I said earlier on, the recipes are amazing. Who came up with these?
So it was a combination. It was somebody I got to know, Orsha Magyar in Canada, who I've seen present or, you know, provide the meals at meetings and always give a short introduction of why this is good and healthy. So she wrote quite a few there, acknowledged. Then, you know, my wife and I actually experimented with a lot of these. So we knew what needs to go into the recipes based on, you know, what I wrote in the book: high fiber, high polyphenol, no sugar, fermented foods. So we wrote quite a few, tested them out, tried them out, and actually have stuck with this experimentation. It's an ongoing process, and it's fun, I would say. Once you go through this, I mean, these recipes are really meant as it's kind of a lesson, you know, that you see how you can put them together. You can make your own recipes once you understand the principle. There's many recipe books out there now of anti-inflammatory diets and gut healthy diets. But if you're interested in creating new recipes and trying new ingredients, this field is wide open, you know. And what you also realize all of a sudden, that many things that ethnic cuisines have, particularly the Indian cuisine or the Asian cuisines, they have many things in there that, if you read up on it, have been thought to have health benefits for a long time. And today we realize a common denominator are these big molecules, these polyphenols or antioxidants that are in all the Indian spices. And so it's a journey, I think, that we have done ourselves. We've gotten a few recipes from an Italian friend of mine. So we want to get family recipes that people have used in Mediterranean cuisine. So it's eclectic.
Well, I guess in conclusion, I would say that when you earlier said you were cautiously optimistic, I can give you a little bit of a support there, because after reading the book, I, you know, assuming I have the discipline, which is something I've struggled with my entire life, but assuming I have the discipline, I look forward to doing this. So I really appreciate this book. But the first one, the cerebral aspect of the first one, I find very intriguing as I go through it as well. So thank you for both of these books, and having a bookshop, an independent bookstore, both the covers of this and the cover of the first one really make a difference in selling it. So thanks so much, Amran, for being with us today. I really appreciate it. It's the gut-immune connection. And it's, as I said, two standalone books. The first is the mind-gut connection. And I and many of my readers at the bookstore, and hopefully many of these listeners, will appreciate it as much as I have.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you. A very informed and sophisticated podcast host. It's always a joy to talk to somebody like that who has the right questions. And yeah, it was really enjoyable for me as well. And I hope it will reach, you know, people that are interested in books and new information about health.
Yeah, I hope so too. Thanks again.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.